On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
It's time to take a look at what's in the Sunday papers today. I'm joined on the line by Mick Clifford, special correspondent with the Irish Examiner, and by Sinead O'Carroll, editor at thejournal.ie. Good morning to you both. Sinead, I'll start with yourself, and just because it was the last question that I happened to put to Paul Reid, and because there's a reasonable amount written today around how Ronan Glynn found himself in the firing line in the last couple of days, any reflections on the degree to which public office holders like themselves are finding themselves in public opprobrium now?
Yeah, I think Paul Reid gave a fairly well thought out answer in that he kind of compartmentalized it into three different areas that he, you know, does have to take criticism, even if some of it he feels is unfair. And I think most politicians would align their views with that, that a lot of time when they meet people in real life, the attitudes can be different to what they're hearing maybe on media traditionally and in social media, because obviously you're often hearing extremes of thought. And then social media, which is just a little bit more of the Wild West. And even this morning, seeing the front page headlines about death threats against Leo Varadkar and people condemning them online, but then being met by more death threats or more talk like that, you know, well, he deserves this kind of the thing, which is quite surprising, because usually you would imagine when people take a step back and think, oh, we've gone this far, that's not a good place. How are we going to get people into politics if this is how we treat them? And that's not even, you know, going down the road of female politicians usually getting more abuse and more targeted abuse. So it's definitely, I think, a time for reflection for people and how they engage in political discourse, and also in the Leo Varadkar point, what's behind a lot of it. Is it just his politics and his policies, or is there more there? And I think honest answers would have to be given to that.
Yeah, I think so. Mick, Twitter can be a difficult place sometimes. And I say this as someone who loves Twitter and has been on it for a long time, but there's always been a certain amount of shooting the messenger. So if the messenger is getting such heavy fire in the last 12 months, you can only imagine what the actual office holders themselves are actually receiving.
Yes, no doubt about that, Gavin. I mean, you mentioned Ronan Glynn, and one of the issues there, of course, is I've frequently seen this myself whenever I throw a piece I've written up on Twitter, and that is those who engage with it read the headline and they never bother reading the piece. And that's obviously not exclusively, but a certain cohort. And that's what would have happened to Ronan Glynn during the week, and he had to come back and say, I'd ask people to look at the full thing. And I can guarantee you they would have had a very different impression if they had done so. But on the broader issue. Shane Coleman had a very good piece today on Leo Varadkar, putting up a picture of himself and his mother on Mother's Day, and the reaction to it was unbelievable. But there is an element, I mean, it feeds into a sort of prevailing political culture, not just in this country, but in a wider sense. And you know, the rise of one strain of what you might call populism, and one element to that is this notion of you have the elite and the virtuous people. And therefore, anybody who is deemed to be a part of the elite can be dehumanized. And once you do that, then you move straight on to this idea of abusing them to that extent. And the very interesting thing is, as Sinead referenced there, when any of these people meet somebody face to face, it's only a tiny, tiny proportion of them have the same type of vitriol or would even have the neck to try anything like that. And in terms of people needing to take a look at things, unfortunately, the cat is out of the bag. I would not be too confident that things are going to get any better than what they are at the moment, irrespective of the consequences. And we've seen in other countries, there can be some very, very serious consequences when this thing keeps going on unchecked.
Sorry, Sinead, go ahead.
I was just going to say, because if the coarsening of the rhetoric continues, there will eventually be real life impacts. I think in Ireland, we're very different and quite fortunate that our people in political life can just be ordinary people that, you know, you can go for a walk around Dublin and probably pass TDs on the street. You can also pass the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach quite often if you're around government buildings. That's not something that happens in many countries. You know, the idea of having full-time security is probably going to be much more part of the Taoiseach's life from
Yeah, sorry, I don't know if Sinead, your line just dropped there for a moment, so I wasn't sure if we'd lost you entirely. I suppose that the one thing that strikes me, and I don't mean to sort of explain away some of the negative commentary, but I just happened, because it was prompted by Shane Coleman's piece, to open up Leo Varadkar's Instagram account, and there's a picture of him with his mother getting elected. And to be fair, the vast majority of comments are broadly positive or telling other people to just park their cynicism for a day and allow a person to celebrate their mother, who, of course, they can't be with because of the lockdown restrictions. But there is that small minority, and I do wonder whether, Mick, sometimes people really realise that the more and more people who piddle in the pool, then eventually they're just going to get everyone poisoned, including themselves.
Yeah, there's no question about that. We've seen that happen abroad. We are a more intimate society here, which is a positive thing, but it also feeds into this whole notion of the element of social media. And let's not forget, even if someone is, as I mentioned myself, it can be a marketing tool, it can get information out there, etc., all of that. But there's also the element of an echo chamber there. And the more people engage in that sort of thing, and the more they keep seeing it on their own feeds, the way it can feed into their own consciousness, we all have our own natural biases and prejudice, etc. And it's extremely unhealthy in that regard, on that level alone, of even how citizens interact with public life and policies and what exactly is actually going on.
Sinead, now that we're fairly confident that we do have your line back, what did you make of how Ronan Glynn became the face of criticism for the last 72 hours or so? Because there are some people who would say, well, yes, he did make a remark off the cuff about people trying to give a little bit more, which was maybe ill-advised. But then you could also argue that the answer that he gave to restrictions being extended until June was taken completely out of context, and that he has also become the face for the government because the government aren't sending anyone out in his place.
I think that's the main thing for me, is that there is so much visceral emotion and anger out there right now. People are completely at the end of what they feel they can give to the country's response to this pandemic. So it's really important that all of the messaging coming from people who are involved in decision making, including the effort and the government, is really well thought out. If one part of that decision making crew aren't there at all, of course the anger is going to be at the people who are sitting in front of us. So if we're being told NPHET aren't making decisions, but then the people who are making the decisions aren't in front of us, then the anger is going to go towards Ronan Glynn, be it unfairly. So I think it should be a wake-up call to the leaders in Cabinet that they need to get out there more and explain decisions. Colin McCarthy had a piece in the Sunday Independent today to start telling us why the restrictions that are in place make sense and why we have to keep them, and why some of the ones that we can start loosening up come April, and why that is. All of this needs to be thought out, rather than, you know, a Thursday night announcement and then we all talk about the restrictions for 3 days without actually having delved into the reasons behind them.
Mm. Brendan O'Connor makes a similar point on the front page of the Sunday Independent this morning. Perhaps it's a cynical take, Mick, but I suspect it's probably a correct one, that the government is only too pleased, in Brendan's words, to subcontract out the running of the country or the explaining of the policies, because it means that the government don't have to stand in front of a microphone and then being accused of partly leaking or trying to mislead people about what is actually coming.
Yes, there's an element of truth in that, but I mean, there's two other issues. One is that, as we saw last Christmas, NPHET had one set of advice, the government took a certain amount of it, didn't take on what may or may not have been crucial elements to it, particularly in terms of indoor dining in that, and only the long term we'll be able to see that, perhaps with research, but there's no doubt they were severely chastened as a result of that at Christmas, and therefore they're less inclined, I suppose, to come out up front, which they should be doing, but also they're less inclined to disagree with NPHET. The other element is that NPHET has become, particularly among people who are understandably so cheesed off at this thing, particularly anybody in terms of economic circumstances, not to mention everything else, that all of us in general are, it's having an impact on us. But NPHET have become, for a lot of people, this body that is effectively running the country unelected, etc. Now, it's of course it's inaccurate, but you're back again to social media and the type of stuff that can go around.
It's an understandable perception when NPHET are out doing press conferences twice, or in this week's case, three times a week, whereas you don't tend to hear much from Taoiseach or ministers or governments or at all.
That's a fair point too, yeah, as well. As I say, that probably goes back, they're going to run and hide after what happened at Christmas. But as well, it's in terms of the way that people are regarding NPHET, and they're taking it that whatever NPHET says goes, and a certain amount therefore are blaming NPHET directly. inaccurately, absolutely, but you're back again to the kind of perceptions that are about, particularly at a time like this.
We will talk about the rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine and whether it was appropriate to suspend it for as long as it was, and some of the Hobson's choices that are facing the government now between trying to keep the public on side but also keep the virus under wraps, when we're back with Mick and Sinead after this. We've got plenty to get through this morning with Mick Clifford and Sinead O'Carroll. And Mick, before we talk about things that are in today's papers, I did want to bring up something that you wrote in yesterday's Irish Examiner, which is about the whole question of suspending the AstraZeneca vaccine this day last week, whether it was an appropriate thing to do. And you're arguing that it's down not necessarily to whether it was the right thing to do from a health perspective, but rather the fear of blame.
Yeah, well, I think, Gavin, that definitely fed into it. And I mean, I think, you know, it's character comes out when people are under pressure. And I'm not talking about individuals here, I'm talking about the national character. And things have evolved to a point in this country, certainly in terms of anything that's done in public life, that whatever you do, make sure you do nothing that comes back to haunt you. So any initiative that's there, the first consideration is, will I be sued, or will my organization or my agency be sued as a result of this? Will I personally be blamed? Everything, I think, to a large extent is down to fear of blame. And I find it difficult to believe that that type of thing did not feed into the decision early on. I think we're one of the earliest to suspend the vaccine at that time. Remember, in terms of the number of incidents of blood clot that were there, the kind of percentage involved is pretty similar to the risk that's perceived to be in something like the contraceptive pill. Mm. So we're talking about a very small risk. Now, I'm not saying there's no risk, I'm not saying there's no reason for caution, but to suspend that the way it was done, particularly in light of the cost of suspending, as in 30,000 vaccines delayed, and hopefully that doesn't mean further infections or anything worse. I just think that when that kind of thing was weighed up, the fact that it must have been at the back of perhaps a body's collective brain, that in this country, you must remember, if anything goes wrong, you're going to be blamed. And I think that's definitely a problem. And then it comes out particularly in incidences like this, where perhaps the more judicious course would have been to go ahead with it and wait and see, because we saw from very early on during the week, this was suspended Sunday, from very early on during the week, the European Medicines Agency was signalling that they did not see a problem. They confirmed that ultimately on Thursday. We lost 30,000 vaccines. And as you were talking to Paul Reid there, pointing out that the delay that's going to cost us, and I would just wonder whether, unfortunately, that fed into it.
Sinead, there's a bit of me, though, that wonders on the flip side, and this is before we knew just how isolated these incidents of blood clotting were, that if you are someone involved in the administration of the health service and you get this report late on a Saturday night or Sunday morning from authorities in Norway that there's been a few cranial blood clots and that a couple of people have died from blood clots to the brain after receiving this vaccine, do you immediately start catastrophizing and then worrying about what's it going to be like if you decide not to suspend the vaccine, and then you find yourself in front of a tribunal years from now asking why you didn't act sooner when you knew there was something to act upon?
Yeah, and I think Mick's right there. I have no doubt that that's what is going through their heads, as well as what they were saying about, okay, we have to make sure that we don't allow this to result in more vaccine hesitancy across the country. But Luke O'Neill has a really good explanatory piece in the Sunday Independent today, talking about precautionary principles. So the precautionary principle there is what you're saying. Okay, we have these reports, we should pause now. That's the sensible thing to do. But what that doesn't take into account is that by pausing, you're creating a new risk of not vaccinating those 30,000 people who are at risk of catching a very real virus that they are susceptible to. So he explains it's a misunderstanding, because as humans we have a terrible trouble understanding probabilities and statistics, but also a misunderstanding of that precautionary principle, because they were looking at one risk rather than the actual real risk of COVID. So I think I agree with Mick. I think that's definitely where the thinking came from. If we get this wrong, but we should have been looking at the UK. And I think I've said this every time I've been on a radio show since December, we should be looking at everything the UK is doing, and not necessarily asking them for vaccines or begging Biden for vaccines, but they have rolled out a vaccine plan that can do hundreds and thousands of jabs in a day.
They did more people yesterday than we have done so far in the entire history of our programme.
yet there has to be things that they're doing that we can learn from. There has to be innovative thinking that has gotten them to that point, that we can say, here, guys, can you give us your playbook? Just let us steal some of it. It's not all just about vaccines, it's about what they're doing as well. And I think we should have done that in this instance as well. Look to Britain, seeing, look, they're way ahead of us. They're leading this game. They haven't paused it. Let's ask them what their thinking is. Let's put that out to the public and let's get on with those 30,000.
Yeah, the funny thing about comparisons to Britain, actually, I know I was only observing this during the last commercial break, that Ireland's most recent figures for vaccinations for Thursday were just published while we've been on air this morning. But we have now given a second shot to a greater percentage of our adults than the UK has. But the UK has managed to space out the gaps between the first and second. And as a result, over half of all British adults now, as of yesterday, have received their first jab. Now, whether that's the right thing to do is debatable. We've had evidence on this programme before that it was the right thing to do. You're better off giving more people partial protection and spacing out the second one. But it's certainly something which I'm surprised hasn't been more actively discussed in Irish circles. On that idea of precautionary principles, Mick, and this brings us to the decisions the government is going to have to make inside the next 10 days or so about, for example, whether it is appropriate to extend the exercise limit beyond 5 kilometres or whether to allow outdoor sport for underage people. You can understand the concern the government has that if numbers are plateauing, the way Paul Reid explained earlier on, that doing anything that allows people to gather any more could do more harm than good.
You can. Just briefly on the vaccines, Gavin, I mean, there's no doubt the EU has made a mess of this. The principle of a centralised control for the countries was positive in theory, particularly for a small country like ours. But the execution of it has definitely been problematic. And I think that's fed into a huge number of the problems. In terms of the opening up, yeah, I mean, it is really now at a very severe point. I mean, I went out early on Thursday, the day after Patrick's Day, for early walk in the park, and the state of the place, and you're particularly talking about empties, cans, bottles, everything, and there's no doubt, and you know, I'm not laying the blame at young people exclusively, but the vast majority of people who would have gone in there at night time would have been young people, and entirely understandable. Lone O'Malley has a really excellent piece today in the Sunday Independent about the impact on young people this whole thing is
very good
disproportionate
piece.
But the point being, though, people are at a breaking point, and one of the big deficiencies I think we have is the lack of a public health infrastructure where you would have a proper test and trace, which could ensure at this point in particular that if you have to continue with specific lockdowns and the type of measures you have to continue with, they could be far more targeted at where the greatest risk is, as opposed to this universal overall lockdown. But one way or the other, I think come April the 5th, the likes of construction, outdoor non-contact training for kids who are under minors, under 18s or whatever, those kind of things, as of now, I don't think there's the evidence is there that they are of a major risk. But the big problem we have this time, compared to the last time we opened up early last summer, is that the variants that are about now are far more contagious. And that adds an extra big problem to the whole thing.
On the discussion around whether it was appropriate to pause the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine, Marie on Twitter says, God, it's so easy to be knowledgeable after the event. Do you ever listen to yourselves? Hashtag vaccines. Another listener says, their boss once told them to make sure that he runs everything through his Joe Duffy filter. How would it look if it was being discussed on Liveline? There's no real way of dealing with this. I should mention other programmes on other stations like Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan and Moncrief on News Talk are available, or you could watch any of the Virgin Media television channels. Sinead, the Owen makes a quite an interesting point. And I want to talk to you as someone who's involved in sport as a woman on this. Owen O'Malley's making the observation that if you combine an ongoing ban on underage sports in a kind of a social setting, and you have a culture where generally girls taking part in sport in schools is not always accepted, and there's not always an accepting culture of them using changing rooms, for example, that the two together could have massive consequences for a whole generation going forward.
Yeah, there'll definitely be people, men and women, who when they're adults will not play sport anymore because of these 2 years. I think there was a line in Owen's piece that really stuck out to me. There'll be a competition not played that would have solidified a young person's life in sport. For the GA, you know, it's like if you went to a FELA competition at under 14, that almost guaranteed that you continue playing past the usual barriers.
Some kids won't have done their school concert in which they may have discovered a passion for performing. Kids will have missed a chance to go to Irish college, which could have ignited the love of their language. It is a very formative time they're missing out on.
Yeah, and as well as that, the friendships that they're making. If you were just to look back at your own life from that 14 maybe to 22 age, the amount of chance encounters, the amount of things that happened that have really shaped your friendships, maybe even your marriages, and how you go about your daily life. And I think they're some of the things that we have to start hearing about when it when we're looking at risk analysis of what restrictions can be lifted and what can't. The idea that kids can play sport, I think, has to be looked at, and what risks are we taking if we don't allow that? I'm not just saying just sports, but I think it's included for the arts and things like that as well. Probably easier to talk about sports because it's mostly outdoor, and you can probably mitigate risks a lot more easily. And the fact that we have a problem with keeping young girls and young women in sport. So I think they're the kind of things that we have to hear from the government about next month. Otherwise, people will start to lose the will to comply, I think, because it'll stop making sense to them.
Yeah, I think so. Very briefly, on the topic of Leo Varadkar and the disclosure that Simon Harris has told detectives that he was asked to share that document with the NAGP as well. Mick, do you see any significance in that, or does it up the ante just a little bit?
I don't see that much. I don't really. I mean, if you're to sum it up, Gavin, the three pieces sum it up. Jean Kerrigan and Owen Harris in the Sunday Independent come from completely opposite points of view. One says the media.
Not for the first time.
Yeah, but one says the media is all basically ignoring the seriousness of it. The other says the media is pounding down on Leo Varadkar needlessly. Where you get a sort of in between, I think it probably hits the nail on the head, is Ger Howland in the Sunday Times. He makes the point, and he analyses it, that it certainly doesn't look, notwithstanding the Garda investigation. And let's face it, the leaks from the Garda investigation, which are just as serious as anything else, but notwithstanding that, it doesn't look like it's criminal, but it certainly politically has impacted on Leo Varadkar and his image as this straight-talking, clean-cut hero kind of thing that he benefited from and he rose on. There's no doubt it has impacted on that. Whether it's criminal or not, we'll have to wait and see, but certainly an initial view of it would suggest not. But look, you can't blame the opposition for making hay on it politically. That's life. And, you know, he would do the same if he was in their position, and they would do the same if they were in his.
Yeah, well, any cabinet minister who is under active investigation for possible criminal activity is obviously going to be a big political lightning rod. I'm going to very consciously not put this question to Mick, because Mick would obviously be very happy to be titled as a Kerry man, and I mean man quite literally. Sinead, have you got any concerns around the gendered titles of news outlets around the world?
Absolutely not. And I actually, the airtime given to this, I'm glad we're all laughing about it, because the airtime given to it this week has been nonsensical. Josefa Madigan, I think, did very well with probably what her initial aim was, to make sure that she was out front and centre for a while. And she definitely achieved that by talking about how we need to, there is absolutely some merit in talking about how we need to get rid of some gendered language, which can create a sense that some roles are for men and not for women. But a lot of that work has already been done. Eilish O'Hanlon makes the point in this and in Independent today that we actually do say firefighter, not man, usually now. We say police officer, not policeman. We say chairperson rather than chairman. So there is a lot of activity already in that space. There's a lot more problems that women need to fight for equality on than whether the Kerry man is renamed to the Kerry people. I also think it's a problem because it's weaponizing language in a way that's actually excluding people who will feel like this is a fight that just does not live in their real world. And I think if people feel like that is what, in inverted commas, lefty liberals are doing, they'll feel like they don't actually know the real problems of people's lives. And I actually think it can do massive disservice to some policies that we actually are fighting for.
It is an incomplete transition, because I'm reminded that Patrick Costello, the Green Party TD for Dublin South Central, is also the Lady Mayoress of Dublin, because he's the partner of the Lord Mayor, who is a woman. So there are some titles that don't quite translate any which way. Sinead O'Carroll, Mick Clifford, thank you both very much.